From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, we look at Iran's perceptions of developments in Iraq.
It goes to show you how nervous the Iranian authorities are about what's happening next door in Iraq.
The United Nations and human rights activists demand an end to the use of torture. The World Health Organization calls the outbreak of Ebola in Africa a sub-regional crisis. And to Russia with love, Muscovites flock to a James Bond show. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry continues his diplomacy tour on the Islamist insurgency in Iraq. A radical group that calls itself the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant has taken control of large swaths of northern Iraq and threatens to capture Iraq's capital, Baghdad. Zlata Sahok reports the group's ambitions may not be limited to Iraq.
The onslaught by the militants began 2 weeks ago, sparking panic among Shia Muslims along their path and an exodus of people from the cities that have fallen under their control. Secretary Kerry told an audience at NATO headquarters in Brussels Wednesday that the threat is not confined to the region.
None of us need to be reminded that a faraway threat can have tragic consequences at home. In the most unexpected way, at the most unexpected moment.
Kerry urged the entire international community to focus on combating the growth of extremism, which increasingly crosses state borders, as evidenced in Iraq.
That's a new animal, in a sense. And I think we're seeing with ISIL crossing from Syria, moving rapidly into Iraq, a similar kind of hybrid, new form of effort, which is going to require people to think through strategically, intelligence gathering, preparations, response times, nature of response. And that's what the NATO alliance has always done effectively. And that's what a lot of today's discussion focused on.
Kerry said NATO members have to work on improving vigilance instead of building permanent bases. The Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, comprises Sunni Muslims, a group that was in power in Iraq during Saddam Hussein's rule. Since Saddam's fall, Iraqi Sunnis have complained of repression under the new government dominated by Shia Muslims. The radical group appears to enjoy support from some disgruntled Sunnis, but Iraq's Kurds also feel betrayed by the leaders in Baghdad. The United States and its allies in the region say a more unified Iraq would be better able to fight the insurgency, but many see that as unlikely. After a meeting Wednesday with U.S. President Barack Obama, Israeli President Shimon Peres expressed pessimism about Iraq and the entire Middle Eastern region.
I told the president that the best thing that could have happened is that Iraq will remain a united country. But I wonder if it's possible. To do so, you need really to send a mighty army to force all the three parties to come together. I don't see the army that will do it, and I don't see the parties that will agree to it.
The Israeli president said the Middle East as a whole is taken up by terror, which causes countries to fall apart. He said the world cannot remain neutral in the face of bloodshed that is taking place there. The Iraqi security forces are organizing to block the advance of the insurgents, but the military has not launched any major counteroffensive. Secretary Kerry travels to Saudi Arabia Friday to discuss the situation with King Abdullah. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
Iran is closely monitoring developments occurring in its neighbor nation, Iraq. According to Middle East Institute analyst Alex Fetanka, the rise of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, is rattling the cages of power in Tehran. We discussed with him the perceptions of Iraq in Iran.
To start off with, I have to say that the overall Iranian position seems to be hardening. And it's hardening in the sense that they are increasingly looking at the situation in a very basic zero-sum game geopolitical framework in that they feel that there are regional rivals, mainly the Gulf states and Turkey, are behind one way or another ISIS and what's happening in Iraq, and that unless they respond, they will lose the influence that Iran has been able to put together in Iraq over the last decade. If you go back a couple of weeks, the Iranian debate was much more, I would say, nuanced. you had basically two factions. President Rouhani's faction, the so-called moderates, were much more willing to admit that Prime Minister Maliki's policies had brought about the emergence of ISIS by basically angering such a big pocket of the Iraq's Sunni minority. The hawks, who are Iran Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, have pretty much from day one been mainly engaging in talk that, you know, speaks of plots being concocted by regional rivals of Iran. But as I said, I think increasingly it seems that the hawks in Tehran are having the upper hand in at least how the Iranian official view on the situation in Iraq is being presented.
Is Iran threatened by ISIS itself? Are their borders secure?
Interestingly, the Iranians have, for the first time in my memory, since the Arab Spring began, have seen the need to come out and publicly assure the Iranian population that they shouldn't worry about ISIS fighters coming across the border from Iraq into Iran and basically do what they've done in Iraq over the last few weeks. The fact that the Iranians see a need to make such public assurances in itself, I think, is very telling. It goes to show you how nervous the Iranian authorities are about what's happening next door in Iraq.
There has been some contact between Iran and the United States about the situation in Iraq, although the U.S. government says there will not be any military cooperation. What is the relationship between the two of them?
Obviously, the U.S.-Iran relations are extremely complex, and they continue to be, have been for 35 years since the 1979 revolution that brought the current Iranian regime to power. At the moment, you have ongoing talks between Iran and the United States over Iran's nuclear program. There has been certain suggestions by the moderates in Iran, including President Rouhani himself, that there are areas where U.S. and Iran could join hands and work together. And Iraq and fighting ISIS has been mentioned as one. But again, we have to see who wins that battle in Tehran, because there is a debate going on still about how Iran should play its hand in Iraq. And number two, it really comes down to realities in Iraq. Regardless of what the hawks in Tehran might believe is behind ISIS, the fact is Iran's primary objective is to maintain as much influence as it can in Iraq. Now, if the only way Iran can do that is by supporting Maliki's, Prime Minister Maliki's request that the United States militarily engage and defeat ISIS, if that's the only way Iran can maintain its influence, then I think they will have to bite the bullet and live with the fact that the American troops are returning, at least temporarily, to deal with the threat that ISIS poses.
Alex Vatanka, senior fellow at the Middle East Institute and author of the article Iran's Moment of Truth with Maliki. The United Nations and human rights activists worldwide are demanding states end the practice of torture, which is prohibited under all circumstances under international law. Every year on June 26, the world marks the International Day of Support of Victims of Torture to honor and support the hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children who are victims of this crime. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Torture is not a new phenomenon. It has been practiced throughout the ages and continues to be employed today in all regions of the world. Reliable statistics are not possible because torture is hidden. It occurs in secret in police stations, prisons, and places of detention. To get a sense of its scope, the human rights organization Amnesty International reports over the past 5 years, it has received reports of torture in 141 countries from every region of the world. And the UN Human Rights Office in Geneva says every day it receives new reports of torture from Asia, Africa, the Americas, Europe, and Oceania. Mona Rishmawi is chief of the Rule of Law, Equality and Non-Discrimination Branch of the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She tells VOA, torture occurs in states that turn a blind eye to this practice and allow it to continue with impunity. While it mainly takes place in repressive regimes, she says torture also occurs in democracies.
The difference is that when it happens, somebody acts. there is a parliament, there is a question in the parliament, the minister gets embarrassed, somebody does something. But if the state really, if the state does not feel accountable to its people, then these excesses happen a lot more.
Numerous international treaties and national and domestic laws prohibit the practice of torture. This year will mark the 30th anniversary of the seminal Convention Against Torture adopted by the UN General Assembly on December 10th, Human Rights Day. Though the convention has been ratified by 154 states, torture continues to be widely and systematically practiced in many of these countries. The United Nations reports 41 states have refused to ratify the convention, and several of them continue to permit torture and ill treatment against detainees. Torture ranges from severe beatings to public sexual humiliation and rape. The victim often is forced to witness pain being inflicted on children or other family members. Mona Rishmawi says the impact on the victim is substantial. While many are left with severe physical injuries, Rishmawi says the worst effect is the mental anguish victims are forced to endure.
These people were victims of intentional injury. These people were intentionally brutalized. You know, the moment you humiliate somebody and you take their dignity away, it's very difficult for these people to reconcile with themselves. It's actually, you know, that moment stays with them for a very long time.
Despite the horrors inflicted upon survivors, healing is possible. The UN Voluntary Fund for Victims of Torture provides humanitarian, medical, psychological, legal, and financial aid to many in need. The fund also supports many of the non-governmental organizations that run programs to rehabilitate victims of torture. Under international law, states must ensure that victims of torture and ill treatment are fully compensated for their pain and suffering. The United Nations is calling on governments to fulfill this obligation. It notes governments are accountable for their actions and warns they cannot torture people with impunity. It says victims of torture deserve justice and those who perpetrate these crimes must be punished. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Health Organization says drastic action is needed to control the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. WHO is ramping up its response to deploying 150 experts to the region. As of June 23rd, there have been 635 confirmed Ebola cases and 399 deaths. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The WHO says the Ebola outbreak in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone is the largest in terms of the number of cases and deaths, as well as the geographic spread of the disease. Dan Epstein is a WHO spokesman.
It's a big challenge for the three countries because it's in rural areas, it's spread across borders, it's also been seen in a city, and it's raised severe concern because it's being transmitted in the community and it has been seen to be transmitted in healthcare settings.
The World Health Organization calls the outbreak a sub-regional crisis that requires firm action by governments and partners. The WHO, the Global Alert and Response Network, and others are deploying a wide range of experts.
Basically, we are putting together the best and the brightest that we can find in a series of teams. One is epidemiologists who are going to the countries, working with the health ministries and the local health officials in surveillance and monitoring the outbreak. Where is it? Where are cases? How did they get transmitted?
Epstein says more laboratory workers will help speed diagnoses and confirm whether or not suspected cases are indeed Ebola. They'll support mobile field labs sent into rural areas.
And then kind of the toughest part of it is clinical management experts that know how to handle people with severe hemorrhaging and what you can do. And they're working with these clinics and these other health facilities to help them treat affected patients. Another key issue is infection prevention and control. We have to make sure that we stop healthcare facility transmission of the virus and community level transmission of the virus.
Others include logistics experts who'll dispatch needed equipment and supplies, and social mobilization and risk communication teams. They'll help communicate with the local population about the dangers of Ebola.
You cannot hide a person who has Ebola. And that's what people have been trying to do. If they see someone who's sick, they're afraid, they hide them. If someone in a village who has Ebola dies, you cannot continue your normal funeral practices of washing the body, having close contact with the body, mourning the body for extended periods. You have to bury the person quickly, and that's it. And so those are messaging challenges.
The World Health Organization is convening a meeting of health ministers from 11 countries and other officials July 2nd and 3rd in Accra, Ghana.
They're going to develop a comprehensive operational response. They want to see what everyone can do to control the Ebola outbreak. Ministries of health of the three most affected countries are reporting on their preventive and control measures.
The WHO has issued a statement saying it is gravely concerned about the ongoing cross-border transmission of Ebola and the potential for its spread beyond Africa. One problem for health workers is the lack of access to rural areas due to fear of the disease. Some workers have been threatened by villagers throwing stones or wielding machetes. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In Libya, fewer than half the eligible voters cast their ballots in Wednesday's election. This as the nation seeks to end the turmoil that has persisted since the overthrow of former leader Muammar Gaddafi. John Stemlau is vice president for peace programs at the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the significance of the balloting.
I think it's a critical moment in the history of Libya and by extension across North Africa, because in 2012 we had the first election in 60 years in Libya. And since then, as you all know, it's been a violent, tumultuous period. This is an opportunity to reconnect the democratic process to the people of Libya, even though turnout has been rather low compared to 2012 when I was in Tripoli for that election.
Also, in comparison to some of the other countries in North Africa, Tunisia and Egypt, how does Libya compare?
Well, it's an interesting question because, as you know, we've had, in effect, a military coup in Egypt. And in Tunisia, democracy seems to be consolidated. Libya falls somewhere in between. We are concerned, everyone must be, by the examples of violence that we saw yesterday during this election for a new council of representatives, including the killing of a woman human rights activist and the shutting down of polls in two of the cities. However, having said that, the images that I've seen coming out of Tripoli reminded me of 2012, where the people of Libya who did show up to vote were very serious about registering their concern that they have a government that has the consent of the people, that it is inclusive, and that there is a process going forward that's bounded by the rule of law. And I think what we've seen yesterday gives us a basis to move back onto that track. So in that sense, I'm cautiously optimistic. It's somewhere between Tunisia and Egypt.
What would you say are the biggest obstacles right now in creating a more democratic process in Libya?
Well, the obstacles are, of course, fundamental in that 40 years of the Gaddafi dictatorship did not build a nation. It gave a powerful authoritarian state at the center, which proved to be very brittle. What they need to do is to bring the three major regions together. And, you know, in the east, it's very violent, but there has been alienation in the south, and there's been some effort to compensate for the history of underrepresentation in this balanced House of Representatives arrangement, that the 200 that will now be elected. And the challenge will be to have a center that holds politically. So that requires leadership. And I've noticed that some of the commentary from prominent Libyans over the last couple of days have admitted that in the outburst of freedom that occurred in 2012 for the very unprepared election that went nevertheless peacefully, they were electing people without political experience, and that maybe this round of representatives will reflect the need to have those who are working for the betterment of government take this job much more seriously than the amateurs of 2 years ago. But that's understandable given how far Libya has had to come so quickly.
John Stemlau, Vice President for Peace Programs at the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia.
Put your flags up in the sky.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit voafootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at voafootball.com.
During the Soviet era, watching a James Bond film could lead to a jail sentence. Despite the ban, many were able to catch bootleg copies during the thawing of the Cold War in the 1980s. This developed into a Russian love affair with the foreign agent. Jim Brook has the story from Moscow.
In 1964, when the James Bond movie From Russia with Love was packing theaters in the United States, Moscow and the West were locked in the deep freeze of the Cold War. Fast forward half a century, relations between Moscow and the West are again in a deep chill, this time over Russia's arming of rebels in Ukraine. But disregarding geopolitics, Muscovites are streaming to a new museum show here called Designing 007. Five floors and 500 props, sets, gadgets, and costumes draw crowds to the Multimedia Arts Museum. Katrina Inozemtseva is the curator of the Bond show in Moscow.
Really huge, a lot of visitors, so around 15,000 in 4 days.
She says we are far from the 1980s, when Soviets secretly watched Bond movies on smuggled video cassettes.
In one of the most popular social networks, VKontakte, so the group of Bond fans, of this fan group, is more than 20,000 people.
For Soviets, James Bond offered an exciting window on the forbidden West. Danila Matsokin came to the Bond show with his wife and six-year-old son.
My childhood, just beginning from the 1780s, so in the Soviet Union, we found of James Bond. It, for us, it's just like a surprise from heaven. Every new film from James Bond, we're just watching on a TV tape, a videotape.
Gayan Danilian says Bond movies radically changed her worldview when she was a teenager growing up in Moscow in the 1980s.
Yeah, of beauty, the idea of adventures and freedom. That was what was motivating all Russians to watch that movie. And style. Soviet people, unfortunately, they were not able to be part of it. So in a movie, let's say, they thought that they are bringing their dream into their life.
Now a grandmother in New York City, Danilian says James Bond contributed to her decision in 1992 to emigrate to the United States.
Women are so beautiful in this country, and they always were looking forward to be a part of the nice environment. In the movies, I think with James Bond especially, they brought their fantasies, you know, as they are the part of this beautiful but untouchable world. Let's say they brought all their dreams true.
Daniel Kovtun, a 21-year-old Moscow economics student, came to the show with his girlfriend. He says the James Bond sex appeal lives on.
He's very rich. He's very cool for the girls because he's a real man and he has weapons, cars, lots of money. He has lots of adventure. So this makes him very interesting.
In Moscow, it is clear from the young Kovtun and the elder Danilian that James Bond fantasies cut across borders and generations.
Did you want to be James Bond?
Sure, I do, yes.
Did you want to be a Bond girl?
Of course. Who wouldn't? Of course.
Cold War or no, it is clear that the James Bond fantasy remains strong for Russians and for Americans. Brook, James Brook, VOA News, Moscow.
Yaki, Susan Yaki. It just doesn't quite have the same ring, does it? Well, thanks for joining us.